Well, it's wonderful to be with you all. And let us go in within, taking in a breath, connecting in the heart center with the divine seed, that perfect spark of divinity found right within you. And just as you breathe, just think of that perfect divinity already fully formed. It is the first without a second. It is the primary cause. It's the primary sustainer, and it's what everything withdraws back into ultimately. And it's right inside of you. All of creation happens right within your own heart, within your own spine, within your own brain. So there is no place that you need go. There is nothing that you need do other than to turn the attention within. And find there that spark of divinity. And when you water it with your attention, you fertilize it with your love, that seed really begins to grow. And it first shoots out its roots down into the ground as it reaches up into the sky, reaching up for the light, reaching up for the breath of freedom, until it finally grows into a large tree that bears fruit and flowers, provides shade for others, and the fruit drops from you as wisdom, divine consciousness, healing power. Naturally, it develops in you and then returns what has been given back to the earth, back to humanity, back to creation. And you are but the witness to what divine consciousness is doing in you. Reading from Master's commentary on the Bhagavad Gita, we're very fortunate in that we have Master's original words rather than the heavily edited versions that are published today. This comes from chapter 14, stanza 4. And it's Krishna speaking. He says, O Arjuna, of all forms, Prakriti is their womb, the original mother, and I am the seed imparting father. In Master's commentary, in a human sense, we consider the common parents of humanity to be Adam and Eve for the first couple, in quotes, possessing other names in various scriptures. Ultimately, however, God the Father and his consort, Prakriti, the Divine Mother, impregnated with his intelligence to become the Mother Principle, are the primal parents of all forms and all life, whether animate or seemingly inanimate, whether angelic, demonic, human, animal, vegetable, or mineral. The next stanza reads, O mighty armed Arjuna, the gunas inherent in Prakriti, sattva, rajas, tamas, imprison in the body the imperishable dweller. In Master's commentary, the three modes of nature are sattva, or purity, rajas, passion, and tamas, inertia, bewilder all those subject to the limitations of a form. The perfect soul appears as the distorted ego when it is reflected in the agitated waters of human life, influenced by the good, activating, and evil qualities of cosmic nature. So this is very interesting. because inherent within Mother Nature is the absolute purity of God. And in the picturesque form here, God the Mother has the womb, and that God the Father projects his divinity into the womb, and through that all creation comes into being. That is the birth. And the firstborn is the Christ consciousness, or Krishna consciousness, what in yoga is called Kutastha Chaitanya. And it is this Christ intelligence that is the Savior, that is the firstborn within all creation. It is spread evenly through all creation. But it is hidden by this veil of Maya, this veil of separation. And as Prakriti, or the Divine Mother, expresses herself as nature, she does it through these three avenues. There is the Rajas, which is the activating principle. There is the Tamasic, that is the deadening principle. And then there is the Sattvic, which is the purity. Now, many times, we think of purity as being the divine attribute. It is being a good person, thinking good thoughts. It is the purity of Christ consciousness that is throughout creation, that comes into your own mind and inspires good thoughts, happy thoughts, pure thoughts. And yet, that is a limitation, as we will soon see. So we go on to the next stanza. O sinless Arjuna, of these three gunas, the stainless sattva gives enlightenment and health. Nevertheless, it binds a man through attachment to happiness and attachment to knowledge. So here's the limiting factor. We develop a sattvic nature. We do those things that are good. We do those things that are beneficial. And this is right, and it is correct from a human perspective. And yet, even conceiving of ourselves as a good person is limiting. I'll give you an example. When I was going through the mystical crucifixion, God took me through a particular experience where in normal life, I always wanted to conceive of myself and see myself as a good person, as doing what is right. And God put me into a position where, through His command, I did something that many people thought was wrong. Now, it wasn't illegal or anything like that, and yet there are many people who are upset with me for doing what I was doing. And it took me a long time to get there. God was commanding me to do this particular action, and I didn't want to do it. It went against my own version of myself, of what I thought was a good person. But God was insistent. And finally I told God, I don't care if I die as a result, because God had told me that if I didn't do this action He was telling me to do, that I would become very sick and I would die. And I said, that's fine. I would rather do that than do this action that didn't feel right to me, that didn't feel good. And He said, no, He says, it's worse to commit suicide. And in essence, that's what you would be doing, because I've told you that the consequence of doing this would be that you would become ill and you would die. And so there I was. And God was commanding me to do this particular action. And so I finally surrendered to Him. And there was some uproar around it. There was some difficulty. People were very unhappy with me. Some people were. Other people, it didn't affect at all. Nevertheless, it put me into a bad light in some people's mind. And that was a terrific test for me, because I always wanted to be a good person. I always wanted to do the right thing and have other people see me do the same thing, to be a good person, to do the right thing. And here it was, God was prompting me to do something that, at least in some people's eyes, was making me into the villain, making me into doing something that they did not think was correct. So I surrendered to that. And it was an important point in my evolution. I went beyond the sattvic of what you even think of yourself as being a good person. And you go beyond that, because that too is limiting. It's an ego reference to yourself as being a good person. Being a good person is doing God's will as you are directed inwardly by God. And yet that may run contrary. Arjuna maneuvered things, Arjuna was maneuvered into fighting this war that he didn't want to fight. And by many people's account, fighting a war and killing people would not be seen as a virtuous, a good thing. And Arjuna wanted to run away from the war. He didn't want to do it, and yet he was a trained warrior. Krishna said, "This is what you were born for. You are a kshatriya. You are a warrior king. And this is your duty to do." And it was an extreme surrender by Arjuna to go ahead and allow himself to do what he felt he didn't want to do. He just wanted to run away and hide in a cave. And we can all identify with that at different times. Sometimes this world just gets to be too much for us. We don't want to have to deal with the things of this world. And we would just as soon just run away. I used to have a fantasy in my mind that running away was driving a convertible car down to California with the sun shining and the wind blowing in my hair. And that was freedom. That was okay. We're escaping out of the things that are uncomfortable and that are difficult here. So it was just one of those passing little things that would go through the mind at times. Sometimes God keeps us right where we're at, because that's where the work is. That's where the overcoming is, and it's uncomfortable. It's difficult. It can be a hellish path at times in order to follow God's will. And then sometimes we feel alone in it. We don't feel that God is with us necessarily, because we've cut him out of our minds. Perhaps we think that we're being separate from him, even when we're not, even when we're surrendered to him, even when we're very focused on him and doing our very best to do good in this world. And as long as we are focused on God, he will draw us through that experience. Just recently wrote about Mother Teresa of Calcutta being canonized, and now she is Saint Teresa. And Mother used to distinguish between saint consciousness and divine consciousness. And saint consciousness was somebody who was still very much wedded to doing good, that they have not yet overcome that and gone into the purity of divine consciousness. This is a definite state that we have to go through. Now, this doesn't mean that we ought to go out and just start acting in a bad kind of a way. That's not it. But when God directs us very clearly and very powerfully to do a certain thing, even if it disappoints other people, even if it puts us into a bad light, maybe even in our own eyes, because we don't want to be thought of as being a bad person by other people, then we surrender to that when it is God who is directing us in that way. But we have to be very sure that it is God. We have to test every spirit that comes to us. So this is the teaching around this. And in the next stanza, Master comments on this last stanza, where Krishna said, "O sinless Arjuna, of these three gunas, the stainless sattva gives enlightenment and health. Nevertheless, it binds man through attachment to happiness and attachment to knowledge. So you can start to understand what he's saying here. And Master's commentary is, Prakriti, or cosmic nature, is composed of three gunas. Therefore, even the highest guna, sattva, is a part of maya, or the delusive force inherent in creation. Did you catch that? Therefore, the highest guna, or sattva, is a part of maya, or the delusive force inherent in creation. Though a brilliant fetter, sattva is still a fetter. A gold wire can tie a man to a post just as securely as a wire of silver or steel. Like tamas, ignorance, and rajas, selfish activity, sattva binds the soul to the body and to the earth plane. By its inherency in nature, rather than in the soul, sattva is powerless to free man from egoism, the root cause of rebirth. I'll give you an example of being attached to knowledge. I knew an individual who was making tremendous spiritual progress in their life, and then they became very attached to the intellectual path, and beginning to read all kinds of esoteric materials, and being captivated by all of these different levels of creation, all of these things that he was reading. And it kept him bound. He actually didn't take that final step into freedom. And he left the body, and he is still very much attached to these ideas. For various reasons, people stop growing spiritually. And one of them is that they can sense that on the horizon, there is this unknown country. There is this tremendous sense of expansion and freedom, but it's terrifying in a way. It makes the person draw back, and they don't know whether they want to surrender to that. And that's when starting to read books and gain intellectual knowledge, when before you had a more direct pipeline to God. Now, reading books for inspiration and direction is a good thing, particularly in the beginning as we gather up all of these different thought ideas in order to perfect ourselves more in the intellect. But there's a certain time when we have to let the intellect back. Go. The intellect is very limited, and yet we have to use it in order to direct our mind. So at some point, we start to let go, and we go into God experience. We let go of the intellect. We become much more simple. We become much more childlike. All the different concepts and ideas that one time fascinated the mind now is being taken up by being in actual God experience. Now, one of the very interesting things about God experience is that it can be very, very simple. And you can try to explain a certain concept. I remember when somebody came to me one time, and they said, well, you always told me that God is everywhere. And she had just had an experience in this, and she said, I realized that God really was everywhere. She said, why didn't you tell me? And then she said, I know that you told me, but how come you didn't tell me? And it's the inability of words to be able to express the actual experience that you have. It is so far superior to ideas and the realm of ideas. And that is where the realm of knowledge, the realm of ideas can limit you, can begin to hold you back unless you are willing to go all the way. In your own meditation, for instance, when you are doing Hong Sa, when you are chanting Om Shri Ram, there may come a time when you enter into a state of total stillness. Now, you don't need to continue to do Hong Sa or Om Shri Ram when that state of stillness takes you over. You would be trying to keep the intellect alive by doing that. It actually lowers your consciousness, where before it had been a tremendous help and lifting you up. Now it becomes a drag, and you feel it that way. You feel that by having to continue the practice, you're actually lowering the mind. Mother had a very highly developed disciple who was in New York, and she called Mother with a problem, and she said, "Mother, every time I start to do Kriya, I go into a breathless state, and I don't know what to do. I can't do any more Kriyas." And she was upset about this. And Mother said she didn't realize that she was already going into God consciousness, which is the purpose for Kriya. The analogy has been given that if you get into a car and you drive to the destination, when you get to the destination, you get out of the car. You've arrived. The car is your focus of attention. It's your meditational vehicle. But when you arrive, when you are in God consciousness, you leave that behind, because that's something of the mind, something of the intellect. And you've gone beyond that. Now, that's not to say easily we dispense with our practice, because it takes time, in most cases, to completely purify the consciousness. So you'll be lifted up into a very high state where it's beyond form, it's beginningless and endless. And then, because your karma has not been completely burned off, you're drawn back down into the realm of duality. And you feel yourself being drawn back down. And then you begin your Hongsa, you begin your Om Shri Ram once again. And then you're raised up and you touch that level of purity. But that level of purity is beyond the sattva. It is the beginningless endless. It doesn't have to do with Prakriti or Mother Nature as expressed as all creation, you see. You've gone beyond that. So this is important to realize, that that is our ultimate goal. Master one time was a round of completely realized saint, and he said, "Don't become too attached to meditation. Meditation is the means for reaching an end. So don't get so enthralled with meditation that you think that's the end." And sometimes you see that. People get prideful. They can meditate for so many hours. Well, one is, I doubt if they're very prideful about it, they probably really haven't contacted God, because God and ego don't go along together well. But that can, you can come back down and you think, "Oh my, look at what I've accomplished. Look at what I have done." That's ego. And so if you're in that state, you've got more to go. You've got longer to go. And so you get right back into your practice again. And you get simpler. You get more childlike. You get more surrendered. You feel that God is the doer. And you are but the vehicle, you see, and that takes you beyond the sattvic state. But that is how intelligence becomes a limiting factor. Back to Master's talk here. By its inherency in nature, rather than in the soul, sattva is powerless to free a man from egotism, the root cause of rebirth, because it's inherent in nature and not in the soul. This stanza of the Gita explains why even good actions can keep a man on the reincarnational wheel. The sattva qualities are themselves pure and untainted by delusion, yet when a person relates happiness and wisdom to his own physical body and brain, his soul has identified itself with the human ego. And man thinks, "I am happy, I am wise," is borrowing selfish rather than egoless sentiments. Bliss and wisdom belong to the soul, but through delusion, the ego connects them with bodily enjoyments and intellectual knowledge. The ego considers happiness and knowledge to be its own qualities, thus ignorantly chaining the soul to bodies and rebirths. Through these ego experiences, deluded and limited pleasures and knowledge instead of realizing the unalloyed and infinite bliss and wisdom of the soul. The good deeds that virtuous men do for others should not be performed for the purpose of attaining name, fame, or ego satisfaction. Instead, all actions should be performed with the thought of pleasing God. And this was exactly mirrored in Jesus' teachings, wasn't it? When you pray, don't do it before other men, as some do, and they do it because others will praise them and say, look at how holy they are. Look at how good they are. When you're able to be in God consciousness, you're not worried about what other people think about you. Do they think well of you? Are you embarrassed by doing what you're doing? That's also being worried about others. God put me into many different situations when I was going through these tremendous spiritual experiences. And sometimes I would be in the middle of a public store, and suddenly He would come over me in this magnetic force. And He would make me move in particular ways, and He'd make me turn around, He'd make me walk this direction and that direction. And it would look odd, and I had to surrender, because here I am, and I'm in a store, and I'm behaving in this odd way. What will other people think? You see, that's the test. That's the test. Am I focused on God and doing what He's directing me to do? Or am I too worried about what other people will think? And as a result of that, stop listening to God. Stop being surrendered to God. Papa, one time when he was walking through a village, somebody said, look, that man over there, referring to Papa, is half cracked, meaning he's a little off his nut, huh? He's a little crazy. And Papa turned around, walked over and smiled at them, said, Ram Dass is not half cracked, he's fully cracked. He owned it, you see. He wasn't embarrassed. He wasn't, oh my goodness, well, see what this person is thinking about me. He owned it fully. And as a result of that, he was free. He was blissful. Because he wasn't dependent on what other people thought at the time. So Master continues here, all his actions being a true yogi happiness and wisdom. He understands that all good actions and qualities flow from the soul and not from the ego. That's so important. Flows from the soul, flows from God. You are but the instrument. Now you are a conscious instrument, so you're aware that God is moving through you, that He is speaking through you, that He is acting through you. So you're not a dumb instrument in that way. And yet, everything comes from divine consciousness. You're aware that everything that happens to you, how God speaks through you, acts through you, everything is an expression of His consciousness, and you feel it, you experience it fully and completely. And as a result of that, you are freed from this comparison. What does this person think? What does that person think? Or even your own ideas of what you think is right and wrong. And Master continues, he knows why good actions performed with egotistical pride will lead to reincarnational bondage, and why the same good actions performed while one thinks of the Lord as the doer will lead to liberation. Isn't that wonderful? Why, if you do it from egotistical pride, it leads to bondage. If you do it with a conscious knowledge that the Lord is the doer, you will be liberated. For instance, when a person eats only with the thought of nourishing the body as a temple of God, he is incurring no karma, not even good karma. To eat with this purpose is to act in service of divinity. The greed of the ego is not being catered to. A man who dies without overcoming the desire to please his sense of taste by consuming delicious foods is required by cosmic law to be reborn on earth to satisfy his cravings. Subconsciously, He is unwilling to stay in a heaven that lacks kitchens and cooks, curries and pies. You see how that works? If you got up to heaven, you would feel that there is something missing. Something missing for your palate. It's more important to you than the bliss of God. Now, this does not mean that, like St. Francis and other saints, you have to throw ashes on your food in order to make it taste terrible to you so that you're not attached to it. That's one way of doing it. There is another way of doing it, and that is to actively feel the presence and the bliss of God while you eat. And if you feel that bliss of God enough, you may not feel like eating at all. But when you do, you can feel the bliss of God, the presence of God, and you can still taste your food. You can still enjoy it because it comes from God, you see. The taste comes from God. The food comes from God. The enjoyment comes from God. And when you connect that in your mind, you become free from the results of that good taste of the food. It attunes you more directly to God so that you don't overeat, because you're listening to God and God will direct you. God will show you what to eat, how much to eat, and you are in total and complete surrender to Him. So that is another place where even sattvic food, those foods that are considered efficacious for the yogi, does not bind you. When you are feeling the superiority of God consciousness, even while you eat, and you do it with the consciousness that you are feeding the temple of God. So you can see how this operates. These are very high teachings. This is a very exacting path when you begin to really entertain this level of discrimination. But it's vastly, vastly important that we begin to understand it, that even the good actions that we perform, as long as we have an ego sense that this is a good thing to do, we're not doing it just simply because God is flowing through us in that direction, but we think this is a good thing. Now, in the beginning, we're training ourselves to think of good and to do good. But as we rise up in consciousness, we'll come to that point where we even have to let go of what is good and go beyond that and go into pure God consciousness. So with that said, are there any questions about anything that I've spoken about tonight? Yes. Yeah.
In other words, keep your mind on God.
Yes. And understanding this distinction between just simply being a good person. I read a story one time about Bill Gates, and of course when he started the Gates Foundation, it was instantly the biggest charitable foundation in the world. And at one point, people were still criticizing him for being a greedy industrialist or whatever it is that they found fault with him for. And this article quoted him as complaining, "What do I have to do in order to get people to think well of me?" You see, so if that's an accurate quote, that's a distinction. He's doing it thinking that people will think well of him. Now, that may not be his primary motivation, but it's somewhere in his mind. I'm doing all of these good things, therefore people should give me a little credit. And that's true. That's true. But if he's attached to that, that will bind him rather than liberate him.
Right.
So from a human standpoint, people think, "Oh, what a grand fellow. Look at all the good things that he's doing." And yet, inwardly, spiritually, he is not winning liberation if that is his mindset because of his attachment to being seen as a good person.
So, David?
Yes.
It seems like the other side of that coin then would be, you know, maybe a person who in the physical world doesn't have much, and, you know, like an example, I guess, would be Papa on just those, you know, couple of years of adventures he was on, where he got, you know, somebody handed him food and he handed it to somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
So he must, because that's what God directed him to do. And so that would be kind of the one end of the spectrum, would be the person who's doing these incredibly world-famous gestures, but it's not liberating them. The other side could be someone who is just simply giving up something or doing something that God directs them, and it's maybe difficult to them, or maybe in a physical sense causing them difficulty, but it's doing what God directs them, so that that seems to be helping to get them closer to God. And so that's an interesting thing about
yes, yeah, and it really doesn't make any difference what position we are in life. And a lot of it has to do with the after effect. So you do a particular thing because God directs you to do it. And what will help you to distinguish it is, do you feel disappointed if nobody notices? If nobody pats you on the back for doing a particularly good thing? You know, if you're disappointed, that just shows up. There's ego attachment here. Now, it happens to all of us on the upward path. So there's no great shame around it in that sense, but we need to pay attention to it and learn from it. So when we do these things, whatever that activity is, and we expect approbation from this world, and we get caught in it. And maybe we don't even think that we're attached to it. But then we notice that we're disappointed, or we're frustrated, or we think that we're not being thought of as well as we'd like to be. I remember one time when I was doing a lot of service for God, and I wasn't getting much acknowledgement for any of it, and I was thinking to God, I was kind of complaining to him. And all of a sudden, the idea came to me that, you know, all of this creation is an expression of God. Look at how much abundance he is constantly giving in this earth to all mankind. All the fruits, all the things that he has given to us to sustain us, to give us enjoyment, to make for a beautiful sunrise in the morning or a beautiful sunset at night. And how many people really thank him? How many people really acknowledge all that he has done for all of us? And I thought, God has been doing that for billions of years. And with little appreciation much of the time. And here I am, I've done this little, tiny, minuscule amount of good, or thinking that I'm doing some good, and I'm feeling sorry for myself because it doesn't seem like I'm getting much appreciation for it. You see? So that showed up as my attachment. And before that, I hadn't thought I was particularly attached to it, but my own disappointment, though my own process of thought showed that I was. So we want to pay attention to not just how we're feeling when we're doing something, but also after the fact. One time I had, it was Christmas Day at an Ananda-shram, and I had bought this nice cassette player because the one at the ashram was pretty burned out speakers, as most of the speakers in India are all tinny and burned out. And they were pretty burned out, and so I tried to find the nicest one I could, and I bought it, and I brought it to the ashram. I kept it under my bed for 2 weeks because I had gone to another city when I got it. And I'd been saving it up, and every night I would go in and I would sit in meditation with Swamiji. So finally Christmas Day comes, and they don't celebrate any Hindu holidays, much less any Christian ones there. But I expected to go in and see Swamiji and present him with this present as a present for Mother's birthday, because she was born on Christmas Day, as well as acknowledgement of Christmas. And I had it all wrapped up and with a ribbon and all of that. And so I went, and unlike usual, the door was closed. I knocked on the door. Somebody came. Oh, Swamiji was in a meeting with some of the directors of the board of the Anandashram, and couldn't be disturbed. So I was a little disappointed, and then Swamiji came to the door because he knew that I was there, and I told him this is a present for Mother, from Mother, and for Christmas. And he just, because he was very engaged where he was at, he just said, oh, well, thank you, and off I went. It wasn't the event that I was expecting. It wasn't the acknowledgement. It wasn't, you know, the whole interchange that I had been looking forward to for weeks. Naturally, I walked away a little bit disappointed. I didn't find fault with anybody. I understood the situation completely. And later, Swamiji was very sweet, and he was apologetic that he wasn't able to give more acknowledgement at the time. But you see, that was my test. God designed it perfectly, didn't he? Was I attached? If I'm feeling completely that I'm the instrument of God, I am happy in performing that action because that's how God is directing me. That's how God is moving through me in that moment. And the fulfillment, the happiness, the joy comes with the moment itself, not with what comes about as a result of the moment. Now, this is a very fine distinction, but as I say, if we're paying attention, we'll notice. We'll notice when we have a particular attachment to something. And when we see, oh, God directed me to do this, this is, I've done what God directed me to do. I presented this stereo unit so that they can have a nice stereo, and I feel good about that. I feel complete. I've done my part in what God directed me to, and I'm complete in that. Then I have freedom. I don't have attachment. It doesn't bind me. Now, in that particular case, I did have some attachment, so there is more work for me to do. So do you see how that works then, and how fine that distinction can be?
David, I have a question about something that you've talked about here, and that is the thing that I've been working the most hard on and that I want the most is to be able to follow God's direction and to listen to God's direction. And I've got a little bit of a hang-up around it in that, you know, I want to do God's direction when it's something that will make people feel good and will, in my estimation, lighten up the situation and, you know, create a good feeling.
Right.
Tells me to do something that is not going to be perceived very well, not very well welcomed, and could even create a fight or a altercation or disappointment or some hard feeling.
Right.
And that's always, and you know, I know intellectually, you know, you're supposed to always follow God's direction, but you know, like in talking to Rick on our walks and things, sometimes he says, you know, he has to call somebody up on the phone and tell them something they don't want to hear.
Yes.
And that's, I mean, I know it's a fault, but it's something that I have a hard time doing. You know, I have a hard time, you know, standing people up or telling them, you know, to straighten out or to, you know.
I'd like to follow God's direction when it's loving, and or with my estimation when it's loving, but not so much when it's going to, you know, create what I think is going to be a problem. And that, I realize that's a big stumbling block, because God's not always going to be telling you something to do that you want to do.
Right. It's being wedded to being the good guy.
Right. That's exactly right.
To being sattvic, which is that it's our version of what it is to be good.
That's right.
But if we could back up and see the bigger picture, I know that there's times when there were two instances in my life when I was let go from positions. And in one case, it was just the owner of the company was just a cheat, and that's just what it was. In the other situation, I was not in the right position. It wasn't the right position for me. And I didn't like it at the time because there was an inconvenience. That was my income, and I depended on that, and what was I going to do now? And that created a difficulty, but it's actually the best thing that could have happened because it wasn't a good fit. I was just trying to do the best that I could, but it wasn't a good fit for me.
Right.
It was actually the best thing to be let go of. And then I could move on and I could find something that would work better for me. It didn't feel very good in the moment, though. So sometimes you do the right thing and somebody else doesn't feel good. They might find fault with you. They might blame you. They're embarrassed. Or you can see that they feel very bad and they walk away. And you don't feel like, oh, I've done such a great thing. And yet it's exactly the right thing to do in that moment. When you see it with a wider lens and you see that what you're doing in that moment is exactly right for that person. There were times when Mother spoke pretty sternly with me, and my biggest goal in life was to make Mother pleased. So it was not easy to have her speak sternly to me. And yet those few times that she did really stuck out in my mind and acted like a pillar that is going along on your journey through the desert. And it was a sign, it was a post, a marker, that gave me guidance, that gave me limits. And it helped me hugely. But I can tell you, in the moment, it felt pretty lousy. That
yeah.
I had displeased her in some way. So if you can play that role for somebody else, you see, you say, yeah, it's hard for me to do. But it's exactly that interaction will correct something else down the road. And you look at it with that wider lens. It's not that you just go around willy-nilly doing whatever you want, but when God directs you to do that, then you know that it will result in a higher outcome. It is exactly right for that individual, even if it makes everybody else in the room uncomfortable. Master said a wonderful thing one time, very powerful thing. He says, if God told me to do something, and in the entire world thought that I was wrong, I would still do it. Now, we could say that. That's a pretty tough thing, isn't it? The whole world thinks that you're wrong? The whole world will condemn you? Ramana Maharshi threw something into the kettle one time when he said, well, perhaps Hitler is a Jnani. He didn't say that he was, but he said, perhaps he is. He's a liberated soul, just playing his part. Doesn't that run contrary to most of our narratives? That's challenging, isn't it? And actually, Ravana, who plays a Hitlerian type role in the Ramayana, it is said that he was a great, great soul who is standing guard up at Indra's heaven. And a saint wanted to get access, and Ravana had instructions nobody was to enter in. And the saint was angry at him, and he cursed him in that moment. And so what was he to do? He had to not allow him to go in, and he had to take the curse. And then the saint said, all right, here's the thing. You can go through many, many lifetimes to work out this curse. Or you can take one lifetime and be the bad guy and work out all of that karma in one fell swoop. So he chose the one lifetime, and he came back as Ravana, who was the archenemy and the Hitler in Rama's time. It stands the world on its head, doesn't it? Here's a great soul who's choosing to play this role out. So when we begin to see it in that way, we go beyond what is good and what is bad. We don't really have the means to measure that. So it's not an excuse for somebody just to go out and behave badly and say, well, it's all the same, because that person will become more and more bound in ignorance by their actions. But when God directs you in a situation and said, no, you stand in here exactly as I'm telling you to stand, that will liberate you. To not do it will bind you. So when you realize that doing that action will result in an ultimate good, even if the whole world were to disagree with you doing that. Tough lesson, huh? Tough test.
Well, you know, I can't help but think of Christ doing the right thing in the story and getting crucified for his trouble.
The whole world, all of his disciples ran away. He was left alone. And he's standing, one man in the middle of this room. And it didn't make any difference whether it was the Jewish hierarchy or the Roman hierarchy. They're finding fault with him, condemning him, ridiculing him, humiliating him, and ultimately killing his body. That's a pretty tough test. And how did Jesus weather that storm? He's, as the story goes, he's nailed to that cross. Has to be excruciating, excruciating pain. He's looking down at his mother. He says, Mother, behold thy son, John, who's his beloved disciple standing next to his mother. Son, behold your mother. He's taking care of his mother, organizing things for when he's gone, so that his mother is taken care of. He's saying, Father, forgive them, these soldiers, these people who have done that. They know not what they do. Look at the level of consciousness that he's exhibiting under such trying, terrible circumstances. And, of course, it's a great, great example for us all. He had transcended. He didn't look at the soldiers as the enemy. They're acting out of ignorance. If you have a boss, if you meet a person who has an unlovely personality, can you think in yourself, Father, forgive her, forgive him. He or she does not know what they are doing. This is something that, you know, we work on, and it's not always easy, but it's always beneficial. So you see how important this lesson is and how we work at integrating it, how we work at integrating it into our lives. And we may not be successful 100% of the time, but we're working on it. We're working on it until we are successful 100% of the time.
Was a good one, but you know, when you feel directed, you feel inwardly directed to do something that you know is going to, or you feel is going to cause trouble, is it going to be very well received? In your case, it actually went away and went opposite to your own sense of what was right.
Yeah.
You know, that's a tough situation, and I wonder how. You know, when you're self-examining, how do you know that that's really what God wants you to do?
Well, I tell you, this was not, for me, it was not instantaneous. God was telling me to do it. I didn't want to hear it. This went over months. And it was finally when God, and I knew that if I didn't do it, that I would get sick and I would die. God made that very clear. And then I said, I don't care. I'm still not going to do it. And God explained to me, that is wrong. It's wrong to commit suicide. It's wrong to intentionally bring that on. And you're not doing my will. And so it was very clear. So part of this is when we're getting that inner direction, we really dig deep. We go through it until we absolutely know that this is God giving us this direction. It's not something that we do on a whim.
So you just continuously ask God, is this really what you want me to do?
Yeah.
I mean, please make your will known.
Yes. Yes. It was a running battle. I didn't
get to call you just because I would still like to really see you before we finish tonight, so I'm going to try and call you here.
Okay. Looks like we have something. Ah, there we are. Pronouns. Lovely. Good. I think we can hang up then. Okay. So, yes, we have to go deeper, and that benefits us spiritually. When we take that on, is this God really directing me? Then we will find that certainty inside of us, but it doesn't always come in a moment. We have to dive deeper. We have to meditate deeper. We have to keep going until we reach that solid ground where we know that this is God's direction. Every effort that we make into doing that will benefit us spiritually because we're going deeper into our own spiritual consciousness. So this is a great thing. Great time for us to take that all the way. You can get to the point where every part of you, every cell in your being, knows what is the right thing to do. You can do that. It's not just an idea that's floating around in your head. It's not just an impulse. It's something that becomes a certainty. And so we strive for that level of knowingness, that we get to that level of certainty. That's all part of our sadhana. That's all part of our spiritual path. So this is a wonderful time to go deeper, to really know it. And then when we know it, then we have to act on it. We just simply do, even though it's difficult. I had people upset with me that I admired very much. what could I do? It was an absolute necessity that I do this. So we can all have different experiences, some of them little, some of them small, but they're all important because they all come down to whether we're following divine will. So if there's still that question in your mind, I don't know, is this really God telling me to do this? Or is this just simply some part of me who's wanting to do this? That's a doubt. Pursue that doubt. Go deeper. Go deeper until you find out, until you can stand on solid ground. And even if the whole world should disagree with you, you know that this is absolutely the right thing to do. Okay. I know we've run over our time, but we started a little late because of the technical difficulties. So it's lovely to be able, I'm glad we're able to see each other before we close up here today. It's wonderful to see you all. I can't hear you, Peter, for some reason.
He hasn't turned on his microphone.
Have you turned on your mic? Now I can hear you.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. I just want to introduce you to a new attendee tonight, David Markowski. He's a friend of mine. He's up here in the blue.
Lovely to have you aboard, David.
Wanted to introduce you to.
You have a good name. Okay. So let us close up then with going inside, closing our eyes, and go to that place inside of you where you feel it is solidly you, generally in the heart center, just right in the center of your chest, where you would point to yourself and say, this is me. This is who I am. And dwelling in there, Ramana Maharshi tells us the size of a thumb. There's a light there, yoti, the size of a thumb. Just see there something more than yourself, something higher, something brighter, something that takes you beyond just that little sense of identification. This is me and this body. This is my name. This is who I am in this world. Takes you beyond all of that and connects you with something higher, something pure, something more beautiful. That is your God self, perfection residing inside of you. Learn to contact that part of you. Learn to contact it and let it take you on a journey. The most tremendous, the most challenging, and the most fulfilling journey you will ever have. It is a journey into knowing who and what you truly are. I ask God and the Masters to bless you in that journey, to bless you in that realization, to bring you into the fullness of that knowledge that you are more than this body, more than the mind, that you have an innate divinity dwelling within you, and that it is the most tremendous experience to explore that, to know that, to become that. Om Shri Ram, Jai Ram, Jai Ram. Victory to God, victory to the light. Pranams, I bow to the light within you.
Thank you so much, David.
My great joy. And we'll do it again. All right.